hope that doesn't do that.
This is a radio recording, and Donna Loring is going to put this on her radio show, so I got to be careful what I say. Well, thank you. I don't know whether you wanted to say anything, Tom. I mean, Bob.
Only in that it's a real honor to have Warren Lyons visit the University of Maine over the last week. His stay finishes tomorrow at the Hutchinson Center in Belfast. And the Division of Lifelong Learning was very successful in garnering a Diversity Libra professorship. And it's under those funds that we were able to invite Warren to campus. It's a real honor for you to be here with us at this time. And the time this afternoon is meant to be with you. So we look forward to this conversation with you, Warren, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Well, my acknowledgement first goes to the native peoples of this part of the world, and I'm now a guest in your area, and that's been our protocol to thank you for that, and to tell you that we come here respectfully. I come here respectfully, and I will, you know, abide your laws and rules. And then I want to thank the University of Maine for this, and the Wabanaki Center for inviting me, and all of the very good friends that I've met since I've been here, and some of the people I've meeting again after a long time. I was up here somewhere around 1972, I think. And I met some of the elders from that time. They come forward in different places, and I knew more people than I thought. So that's my first acknowledgement. I've been here for quite some time. Very unusual for me to be in one place for as long as I have. It's generally 1 or 2 days and I'm moving. But I've been here since last Monday. And here we are again, a full week. Had the good fortune to spend time with my friends here and this weekend and get a look at your beautiful country, very, very old fishing grounds, old camping grounds. People lived here. You know, one thing about people, I don't care what century they live in, they always go to the very most beautiful places they find it, and always set up camp. In that respect, maybe the beginning of the discussion, I learned from different people from around North America and even further, indigenous people. But North America, long ago, when there were just the native peoples, and it's not to say just, but there was an awful lot of native people here. They had a tremendous respect for the earth and for the natural world. And when they moved about and they camped by these favorite spots along the river where they knew the fish were biting or the most beautiful place, there were these places that they just stopped again and again. And there was sort of a game they played. And the game was to spend your day or two, how long you were at this camp, and then when you left, to erase every indication that you were there. Carefully erase your presence. And as close to when you arrived as when you're leaving. And the next person or group that came in would come in and they would study the campsite and they would try to guess how long ago or if anybody was here. And they all did that. And you never left a trace of yourself. It was not only a game, but it was also a process, a way to respectfully spend your time at this particular place and to leave it the way you found it. Unfortunately, today, the different cultures and the different ways of life, not only do they leave traces of who is here, they leave monuments. Large monuments, almost equal to their ego. And they named the place after themselves. You know, all of these places in North America, and we'll kind of just stay in the area here, all had names. Every place had a name. Every river had a name. Every town, and they all knew those names. And I don't think any of them ever was after a human being. It was after something that happened there, an event, or the place itself. So what I'm talking about is the practical approach to being respectful about where you live and how you live. And always in regard to the next one coming. Really important. And that would go on even to the next generation coming. And even beyond that. So we're talking about a way of life. A way of life that reflected the values of the people who lived there. Pretty common way when you move around the whole world and you talk to the different places and the different people. Always with respect. We'll move up into contemporary times, in today's times, and some of the situations that we're facing now. Cultural devastation of places, lands being exploited and not repaired, resources of water and food, and maybe just a place to be challenged now all over the world. When we talk about those times, long ago, there weren't that many people in the world, if you wanted to count them all. There were just few compared to what's here today. Compared to what's here today, there are very few. Still many. So today, we have 6.7 billion people in the world. In 1950, we had 2.5 billion. 59 years ago, we've more than doubled the population in 59 years. Yeah, that's not very sustainable. In fact, it isn't sustainable. So, that's an issue, the human population. And it's an issue internationally, with the natural world in particular, because there's very little defense there. And so in today's times, as we count 6.7 billion, probably 8 by the time we're here today, probably very soon 6.9, because it's exploding. It's building exponentially. It's compounding. It is not just growing, it's compounding. And it's accelerating faster and faster. And so as we think about this, and then as we maybe take a census, you know, this about to take a census, I hear, of the human population. Well, you know, taking a census of how many gorillas are left in the world is very easy now, because you can count how many. In the hundreds. Or how many tigers? You can count them. Or how many elephants? Talking about the natural world. You can take a census there and you'll find that there are fewer and fewer and fewer. There used to be a balance of all of that. And the balance supported everyone. We lived with them. We worked with them. They shared themselves with us. We had ceremonies of Thanksgiving for them. You just didn't take something. You paid respect. There was a way to do things. Always respectful. A life is a life. Whether it's a tree, whether it's a mountain, a moose, or a mouse, it's still a life. And they work collectively, these lives, for the good of everybody, for the good of all of us. So now we're coming to that point where we can count mostly human beings. And that is at the expense of everything else. So we come to a great imbalance, a time of imbalance in this world that we live in. And the imbalance is too many human beings. And depending on where and who you're talking to, it becomes a difficult subject, because it becomes a political subject or it becomes a religious subject. But in the natural world, it becomes a subject of life and death, regardless of your politics or regardless of your religion or anything else, because there's a balance factor here. Some of the things that we know, we being indigenous people, not only us, many people know. First of all, there's no mercy in nature. Nature has no mercy whatsoever. Does have a lot of rule, does have a lot of law. And that's what we learn. We learn that law and respect that law. We live within that law. And living within that law gives you a long life and gives you children life, and it just goes on one big cycle after the other. Somewhere along the line, I don't remember where, I was questioned one time in kind of a meeting like this. Well, Chief, what's your bottom line? That made me sit up. Because I didn't know. That is a question. I said, what is my bottom line? And I told the person who asked the question, you know, I said, I'm going to have to study that. I can't answer you because I don't know. What is my bottom line? So I thought about it, and I came, first of all, to understanding, what is a bottom line? Well, what is that? And of course, all of us in this world that we live in today, we know what that bottom line is. It's the last line on profit or loss. It's a monetary discussion. He was putting a monetary discussion in the spectrum of life. Well, I guess we live in that. But I said, well, wait a minute. So that's the bottom line. Okay. Well, then what is my bottom line? And then I said, well, you know, being who I am, the Onondaga Nation, living within the community I live in, and living the cycle of life that we live in, from one ceremony, Thanksgiving ceremony, to the next, around the lunar clock. I said, I don't have a bottom line. I live in a circle. No bottom line. No end. Took me a little while to figure that out, you know, because it was a good question. Because I've been spending a lot of time in my brother's boat, and I know a lot about his boat and all his rules. So no, I said, we don't have a bottom line, because we live in a circle, cycle of life. Very powerful cycles of regeneration. It's regeneration, it regenerates life. Spring, summer, fall, winter, spring, summer, fall, winter. You know, you wait in the spring for the ducks and the geese because you're so skinny from eating rabbits all winter, you got no fat left. And just about the time when you don't know whether you're going to survive or not, here's spring. And here comes some fat, juicy geese and ducks full of grease. And we're right into that. And we start again. And the leeks and the wild onions and all the things that grow that we live. Can't wait for the greens. Greens are great power. Lift you right up. So it's a cycle. There's no bottom line. But in today's times, that's about all you hear about is the bottom line. Serious discussions going on right now in the Congress and the Senate about the health care. Bottom line, what does it cost? Who's paying? Who isn't paying? Pretty confusing discourse going on out there. That's the bottom line. But it's an economic line. Important to be sure. Important to be sure. Can't discount it because that's just about the way we all live today. Nevertheless, the earth remains the same. Because we choose to do a different lifestyle, because we choose to do what we're doing, does not change the earth at all. We can scar it up, we can use this, we can use that, and maybe at the end of this discussion, we do away with ourselves as a species. We just do away with ourselves. That's well within the capability of our hands. Maybe that's what's going to happen. I remember as a little boy, I used to get scared when people would talk about the end of the world. I kept hearing about the end of the world. Oh, that's a scary thought for a little kid, you know. I'd sit there thinking, what's that? What's that like? My kid brother, who was just, we were so close together, we're almost like twins, Lee Boy, he knew that scared me. And he would come next to me and say, hey, Sonny. I said, what? He said, end of the world's coming. And I would get scared. And I would go running out, trying to find my mother and say, end of the world. She says, Lee Boy, leave him alone. But it used to scare me. Because it had this impending disaster I couldn't even visualize. And then as I grew older, I said, well, the world's not going to end at all. It has its own cycle. And then as I became more comprehensive of what the situation was, I said, well, maybe we're going to end as a species, but that certainly isn't going to end the world at all. And if we do, in fact, take ourselves to that position, what will happen in the world? Well, you know what? It's going to get green again. It's going to clean all the water. Everything that used to be will be back again. Because it knows how. That's what it does. And its biggest problem, which right now is us, will be gone. And so what will it do? It'll re-energize itself. It'll reconstitute itself because it has this powerful, very powerful law of regeneration. It knows how to do that. That's why we call it our mother. It knows how to keep us alive. And so, that's the way it'll be. And the reason why it can be that way and we can't do it that way is because the world has all the time in the world. It's got all the time in the world. That's a long time. And we have these short runs. We got the short stint of why we're here. You know, you're lucky. You'll make the full generation, anywhere from 80 on. Many of us don't, but it's a general, that's about where we're at. You get to my age and you're on a short, very, very short end of the stick. And what happens there is you start to get busy trying to finish your work or finish up stuff and get things done. Don't want to leave a mess. I want to take care of things, you know. It's like getting the wood ready for winter. But you're not getting it ready for yourself. You're getting it ready for your family. You're getting it ready for your children. You're getting it ready for the next generation. That's what you're working for. That's what you're working on. And everybody does that. I mean, that doesn't belong to Indians. It doesn't belong to Black people in Africa, or they all do it, we all do it, we all have that understanding. Except maybe corporation presidents. They're not thinking that way. They're not thinking that way at all. But it seems to me that's who's in charge these days. So, here we are. And here you are in this room. We got a little while together. Now, just to clear any misconceptions, people say, oh, let's go hear that old man, he knows a lot. Well, I know some stuff, but really, I'm a runner for the Confederacy. I'm a runner for the Haudenosaunee, Six Nations, Iroquois. I'm a runner for the Onondaga Nation. I'm a runner for the chiefs. I carry their message. I go hear stuff. I bring back news. I travel because I speak the English language very well. I speak it very well. I understand it very well. But not much more. And so that's my instruction. Well, you go. You can talk their language. You go. Tell them what we said. So you don't want to get the idea that I'm some kind of a wise man. I'm just a runner. But in the course of a life, you'll be surprised what you pick up. You'll be surprised what you learn. And in fact, you do turn to the old people. You do turn to them because when their times are hard, they know. You know, they're always there. They're always there waiting for you to ask a question. Most of the time you don't ask the question until you're almost flat on your back and then you say, well, I better go see Grandpa or Grandma. You try to tough it out yourself. Instead of, as a kid, going over there, they're willing to start teaching you as soon as you sit there. As soon as you come, they'll teach. Always sit there. I remember one of my young, I don't know what to call him, because he's, I think he surpassed me in my capacities, a John Mohawk, who I always called a resident intellect of Iroquois. a very smart guy, very brilliant. He could analyze things, and sometimes he'd talk about things and you're trying to understand what he said and he's already 10 sentences ahead of you. You just can't catch up to him, you know. But John was he was also a farmer. So John planted. He planted a lot of corn, you know how. He got it from his father. Could sing songs too. Could sing the songs we needed to in the longhouse. And brilliant. He was really a good companion. Anyway, John, he analyzed things. He would be able to say, well, you know, this happened before, and this is what we did then. And he would know. And he took the time to go to the elders. So now he was at the university. I was a professor at the University of Buffalo. And John was my student. In fact, there was John Mohawk and Barry White and his wife. About four of these people were just dogged me down to where I cornered me up and say, you got to come out and you got to start American Indian Studies Department at the University of Buffalo. And I said, well, that's not what I do. I said, I'm IRS. I got a lot of work to do. And I'm at the council. I got that work. And come on, you can do it. You got the credentials. We need it. They did dog me till they cornered me up till I had to go. So once I went, I stayed there. It was 1971. And I retired last year. But it was John. So now I'm the professor. And John is doing his master's. And he says, you know what I want to do my master's in? I said, no, I have no idea, John. What do you think? He says, you know, he says, we've lost, or we don't know where this Indian potato went. We had a potato, an Indian potato, that would last in the ground for 4 years. You could put it in the ground, it would be there. It wouldn't rot. A small, hardy potato. And we don't know where that is. It's in the beans. We used to grow 15, 20 different kind of beans. He says, where are they? And he would start talking about the things that we didn't have anymore, the varieties of food. I said, John, what are you getting at? Well, that's what's going to be my master's course. He says, I'm going to find these. I said, well, that's pretty good. And he's going to make a garden. He's going to make a community garden like we used to make. Okay, John, I said, that's a good idea. Oh, I said, but you know, you'll have to wait till after harvest for your grade. It's all right, he said, it's a bargain. So off he went. And he went to all the Six Nation reserves. And he visited old folks here and there, you know, and he found beans. He found old couples, some of them living yet in the old log houses, you know, that 400, 500 years old. He's still living there. And outside in the corner by the doorway is growing these beans. And they're keeping the beans alive for seed, waiting for somebody somewhere along the line come back and ask for them. And lo and behold, here comes John. You know anything about beans? Sit right down. And so John found these things. He was all over the place. And you know where he found the potato, or as close as he could get to this Indian potato? He found it in Cooperstown, New York, at the farmer's exhibit there. And they had a 17th, 18th century farm. And they had some of these old things. He found it. So who had it? Well, it was our white brother that had it. That's where he found it. Because we didn't have it. And then he did build a garden. And he's from Cattaraugus, Seneca. And he built a garden. He got all these young people and they built this community garden. And you know, they had so much that came out of that garden, they couldn't keep up with it. And they were driving around from one nation to the next, and any of our doings, any of our meetings, any of our ceremonies, any of that, there they'd show up and they would have a whole pile of food and they would leave it. These were the young people. And this was John's inspiration. So when I say, and he had a great father, his father was one of the leaders in the longhouse tradition. So that's where he learned the songs. And of course, he would go to the ceremonies. So he knew all that. Plus, he was about the smartest guy I ever saw. He could remember things where I couldn't. So we depend on John. We depend on him for a lot of things. And he's the one that took over Akwesasne Notes during the 70s, and he made that a very strong paper. He came to me one day, he says, "I have an offer. I don't know what to do." I said, "Well, what is it?" He says, "Well, there's a law firm that wants to hire me. There's a lot of money." He said, "They want to hire me, and they're in Washington, D.C. And they want me to be part of their board. On the other hand," he says, "we're having a lot of trouble these days," and he's talking about those 70s and 60s, and where we had a lot of Indian action, as you remember, some of us remember that. And he said, "Well," he said, "I also got the offer to do Akwesasne Notes." And he says, "It's a hard choice, because if I go to Akwesasne Notes, I'm going to be living in the woods there, and we'll be living hand to mouth, and I don't think there's anything going to be paid, but we'll have to generate our own funds." He says, "On the other hand, I'm being offered a very lucrative arrangement." I said, "John," I said, "you're asking me to make a decision for you." And I said, "I can't do that. But I can tell you this, John, you're going to be a lot more helpful to us at Akwesasne Notes than you will be at that. I can tell you that." "Good enough," he said. And John went and took that Akwesasne Notes and made it a real amazing paper. Well, John, and we have other people like that, but I just put him up as an example of what our people are and how capable they are, and they're all amongst us here. They're young people, and unless you help them, unless you help direct them, and hopefully somebody's there to give them direction at crucial times in their life, you know, that's where the old people come from, that's where the community comes from, because they're available. They're standing there waiting, just like that couple with the beans, waiting for somebody to come and ask. It's like that around the world. We're not the only ones, all over. Same thing. So each generation then is responsible for itself. I mean, you can't live your daughter's or your son's life as much as we'd like to and as much as we try sometimes. No, they have to learn themselves and have to bear whatever they do. But if it was possible, you know, most of us, including myself, would gladly do something for them that they, but we can't. So what's the best thing that we can do then is we can give them good direction. Good direction, that's what we can do. That's what we're there for. And safe haven, a little protection out of the wind if things don't go right. There you are. That's what you're there for. And those of us who have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren know that never stops. They never catch up to you. and you're always the elder. Maybe way down the road, you might need their help, and they'll come help you. If you're there, they're there. So our societies, indigenous societies, really built on that style of life. We had large extended families. We called them clans. That was our identity. That's how we lived. That's who we were. And if they ask me, when I hear now and then, well then, who are you? And I always use the word we. I never say me. I learned that long ago. Never use me or I. It's always we. And I'd answer, I said, we are the ones who give thanks to the earth. That's our mission. That's what we do. And we do it good. We know how. And everywhere I go in indigenous country, I see these ceremonies. And I know what they're doing. Whether their language is different, doesn't matter. I know what they're doing. And your family, right away, they move you right in. You sit right there. And your participation, your presence. You learn these things, you know, by little incidents. You learn something just by little chances, so forth. I remember talking to one of my friends. We were going to, some kind of a meeting at Onondaga. And we were young people, we were young men at that time. I was a very young man. And one of my friends coming down the road, and I said, you're going to go to this meeting tomorrow. I said, you're going to say anything? You know, you're going to be at that meeting, say anything? He says, no, he says, I'm not going to say anything, but I'm going, he says. I'm going. And I said, what are you going to do? He says, I'm going to make the crowd bigger. You know, I thought about that. I don't know how many times during my life those words come back to me. I'm going to make the crowd bigger. And maybe that's all you can do at that moment. And that's what he was going to do. It was a big mission, because if everybody didn't think that way, there would be no crowd. So you're needed. Your presence is needed. You don't have to be speaking. You don't have to be, you know, making a great speech or anything, but you're there. And by your presence, you're saying, I'm here. I'm going to make the crowd bigger. I forget that. I'm passing that on to you. You know, we don't have much time here, but that's something to think about. When people think, well, I don't have much to say. Well, maybe not, but if you're there, it makes everybody feel better. So it would be the same at this meeting here, and there were 6 people or 10 people here. Well, all right, we'd deal with that. But look, we got a good crew here. You make the crowd bigger. It's helpful to all of us. Makes everybody feel better. So, I know sometimes it's easier just to say, well, I think I'll stay home. I don't want to go out and get in there and do all that again. But think about that. Think about your duty. Think about what you can do. And then maybe that's exactly what you can do, is put your coat on, go over there, and make the crowd bigger. So these kinds of things are lessons you learn over a period of time. And age, there's no way that you're going to learn something without experience. When they said that Obama was going to be president of the United States, I said, well, at the very best, he has only 46 years of experience. At the very best. He's smart, which he is. He's dedicated, which he is. He's good principles, which he does, but still, he's only got 46 years. And you know, when you look in a nation and you look at those 46-year-olds, they're pretty bullheaded. They got a lot of energy and they run things at home, but they're not the leaders. Leaders are older. But here we have him. Okay, so he needs a lot of help. He needs a lot of support. He needs some direction. Now that's how you think. You have to know what each age does, you know. You have to know what is your work. We were out in Montana, elders meeting, we mentioned, traditional circle of elders and youth. And I took my kids out there. Boy, nephews. Good camping trip. They were young, just anxious to go and see. And you know, it is when the kids are running about in a camp or in a meeting like that, you think they're not listening. Or you think they're not hearing stuff. But you'd be surprised what they're picking up and how big their ears are, you know. They're listening. You just don't think so. But they're there. Now we're talking to this old man, Northern Cheyenne leader, spiritual leader, traditional man, Austin Two Moons. And he says to us one time, talking about this, what are the age groups? He says, well, he says, you know, he's explaining their Sundance to me. This pole, he says, that's when you're born to when you're 20. He says, everybody's in there as kids. They're all children. That pole, that's the next generation or the next step up. He says, they're still young, but they may even have children, but they're still learning. You know, and on he went. Anyway, when my son had his first baby, and he married a young girl, he was younger than he was. They were both young. Nah, to have a baby. So I'm standing there, looking at this 10-pound boy, 24 inches long. I said, geez. And he says, boys, that's a close call. And I said, what are you talking about? Oh man, he says, remember what Two Moons said? He said, now my birthday is here, and Monty's birthday is here, the young boy that's just born, and it's born like, his birthday was January 27th, and Monty's birthday was April 15th. And he says, you know, Dad, he says, we're almost all children at the same time. My wife, myself, and my son, he's all kids, born at the same time. He says, but he just got to be 21. He says, boy, that's a close call. And I had no idea that he remembered that, and that he was even there when he was talking. I didn't know that. I forgot all about it. But there he was. He soaked it up. He remembered it. He was thinking about it. So these children, you think they're not listening. Yeah, they are. And then all of us remember when in the old days we'd be all listening right around the pipe hole on the ceiling, listening to what they're talking about downstairs, you know. Just quiet up there listening. Yeah, kids know. So they hear everything, so keep that in mind, you know. You're bringing them up. What I'm talking about now is simple life, everyday life that we know, but that's basically what we do. We live everyday life, every day. I mean, every day is what we have, actually. And My philosophy now, I have a philosophy finally, and it's get the best out of the day. That's my philosophy. Well, you get that way anyway, the older you get, because it's one day at a time anyway. So you become more aware of that, you know. So you get the best out of the day. And if you do that every day, then you're not waiting for some major event, you know, that you save money for and then finally have it and then it goes away and that's it. No, if you learn how to get the best out of the day, then you're really living a good life. And you're really absorbing what happens, because so many things happen in one day. And then our instruction, of course, is to, when you wake up, is to give thanks for waking up. No guarantee you're going to wake up. So now here you are. It's okay. That's the first Thanksgiving. And the last one at night is for the day itself and all that happened. So it's a way of respect and a way of broadening your enjoyment. You know, I think that's why we like stories so much, because they're instructive. And some good storytellers. And I don't think you get better storytellers than Indians. They're really good storytellers. They know how. And at the end of it, there's always a lesson. They never tell a story without some point. Maybe take them a long time to get there. But they get there and you remember it. So today, our children aren't listening. They're not learning from us in our stories. There's a television set going, or there's a computer going, or there's a tweeter going. Somebody else is teaching them. Somebody else has got their hands on them. Unless you're aware. And then you wonder why they do something, you know, and you don't understand it well. Not paying close enough attention. It's hands-on, this business of raising children. It's hands-on, as you all know. Closer attention, the better off they are. The more disciplined, the better off they are. You know, it's just a problem for them if they're not taught early enough. They get into trouble. So the large family, then, the clans that we had and have, you know, I've been sitting for the Turtle Clan for since 1965. It's a long time. It's over 40 years of sitting on a council. And big family, Turtle's a big family. And they borrowed me. They borrowed me from the wolf, because I'm a wolf. It's my clan, it's a wolf, but I borrowed over to the Turtles, and I've been sitting there all these years. It's temporary, they told me. Now my kid brother is sitting in the principal position. Anyway, in this large family, we have friends and we have support. We have support in a community, a large extended community, and that community extends to the animal world, and that extends to the plant world. That community is big. It just keeps going out and out and out, you know, and the more you learn about your community, the better. And how you relate to one another, what you do, how you fit and are productive in what you do. You have to learn about your neighbors and so forth. And we did. Indigenous people really knew. I could tell, you know, just, they knew things. It's old people, they knew things. And watching a cornfield with the old man. Oh, look, he says, there's the medicine corn. And I'm looking at the big cornfield, you know. Rows and rows of corn, and he says, oh, there's the medicine corn. I said, where? What are you looking at? He said, see that bird? We were there as a bird. He said, that bird only lands on the medicine corn. So we have to go find that one. Keep track of that, he says, because that's the one in the field. That's the only one that knows that's that bird. Well, I didn't know that. I'm just lucky to be standing to him by this man when he said that. He said that like everybody should know that. And I guess at one time everybody did. But not anymore. Well, corn comes in a can now. You know, everything comes in a can, comes in a package, comes wrapped up. So you lose track. You lose track of what keeps you alive, and you lose respect in the meantime, or you just don't have any knowledge whatsoever about it. So, I guess what I'm saying, and kind of rambling around here, I'm not talking much about international stuff, am I? I'm just talking more about home, and more about what we know about, what we have to deal with every day. And just kind of reminding ourselves of how much and how important it is. Sometimes we say, oh, they're always doing these big things, and going to these big places. And, well, you know, after you've been to these big places and big things, you find out they're pretty hollow sometimes. And get over there long enough, you find out they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Or if they are, you don't know what the hell they're talking about. So it's important. I'm talking about community now. Community being our family and the extended family. And that's what brings us to the issue of global warming. And now that's a very serious issue. And I've been at this business for a while now, and I'm spending a lot of time on it. And as a matter of fact, I met one of your scientists here, Paul.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, the president, Mr. Kennedy, another scientist, CO2 specialist, can you imagine? And I talked to him about our meetings that we're holding internationally. And I said, you guys should come. We need you. So we're thinking about that. And then I'm thinking, gee, this University of Maine is a pretty good place. There's a lot of stuff going on here. I had no idea about, you know. I said, you know, because Maine's kind of way over here. You know, you gotta make up your mind to go to Maine. You know, it's not. So I said, well. So now, you know, and then I find my friends. Bob Scott, Pat McCoy, Malasutes, Mick Max. I know these people. Long ago, I said, gee, gotta get back. So I'm going home when I'm from here, and I'm gonna talk to the chiefs, and I'm gonna tell them, look, guys, we gotta make our path better going up this way. We gotta talk to them more. All doing the same thing. And then they got a good place up there. Called the Wabanaki Center, and that's another confederation, and we know that confederation. We know that one, and we got wampum belts, old ones. We got wampum belts between the two of us. I had to remind them, we have wampum belts with Anishinaabe. We got wampum belts with Cherokees, Choctaw, even Seminole. Old time, long ago. You know, we're related. We're related, Indian nations. Really related, close. Languages are close, customs we know. And then when you really go to, say, maybe the West Coast Indians who are really different, then you learn from them. And they're related all up and down the coast. So that's how we operate. That's how we are. And then our brothers and our sisters, when it came from the water, across the water, we're related. We're related close. And we have to get back to that. And I think that one of the missions that I talk about now is how we have to do away with this idea of racism. We just don't have time for it anymore. It's a luxury we have to do without. It's just like war. War is what we like to do. But things are getting to the point where, no, you don't want to do that. It's taking too much energy, it's taking too much money. Get back to the community. Peaceful coexistence, living together, working together, doing the best you can, supporting one another. That's what we used to do. We'd have runners come and go, glad, always glad to see a visitor. Sometimes he'd bring in news, you know. We always had a house, you know. There was always a place for them to get a rest, eat, calm down. Maybe in a day or two, then we'll hear the message. And then they tell us. And everybody will sit and listen. Those people were our messengers. Well, all of that. We have to be aware now in this time of the technology that seems to have grabbed our young people. They're living in a different age than us, and they're operating in a whole different way than we are. Now, even as a professor, I still don't have a computer. I use this old style, write it. And even older was just remembering what they said, write nothing. I remember. And now we have a whole way of communicating, and I see people computer, you know, in the same house, using the phone or using it upstairs. You know, could just come down and say something. No, I'm be here. That's really different from us, you know. But there it is. It's a reality. You have to watch. Watch what's in that machine. And who's in charge. Had to watch. Have a friend. And he wrote a book called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. Jerry Mander. Anybody know about that book? Anybody here? One Indian, and the rest of you guys don't know, Jerry Mander. He wrote a book, Four Arguments Against, you know, for the Elimination of Television. Why? And he lays it down, why? Destroy the community, destroy the family, get people separated. Yeah, Four Arguments. Very well read book, people will. Way back in the 80s, early 80s, he wrote that book. And he came to Onondaga. Jerry finally got to Onondaga. And he was an interesting guy to us. Told us a lot of stuff. He said, yeah, the computer works. It works for everybody. He said, it really works, but it works the best for the government. They get the best out of it. You get the use of it, but they know who you are, they know where you are, they know what you say, and they know what you're thinking. And I said long ago, I don't think I want a computer. The same with a cell phone. You know, people don't know or forget or doesn't matter that you're talking directly to the federal government in that cell phone. They have a huge network of listening to what you're saying. So I don't have a cell phone either. I said, you want to talk to me? Write me a letter. It's about the securest communication right now. But it's something that you forget about or you don't think about, and after a while it becomes second nature, and then second nature is good for them. It's okay for you, and most of the time I guess it doesn't mean anything. But if it does, I have to remember one thing. You're talking to somebody else there. I just remember. I said, what does that mean to you? I said, well, I'll just say to you that if you're going to be using a cell phone or talking to me, I said, don't say anything that you wouldn't say to a state trooper. So it's the day and it's the age. And probably things are going to be even more amazing. But in the meantime, we have a problem. And the problem is global warming. And the issue is time. Time now. Time's a factor. We should have been getting ready, well, at least 30 years ago, 40. This summer, we were in Sweden, and we said, and one of the guys I work with there on this issue of warming, big Swede by the name of Lars Larsson, he said, you know, he said, we should go up and talk to the old man. I said, who? He said, the old Sami man, reindeer herder, old man. Go up and talk to him. See what he says about this stuff. I said, okay. So we had some leaders from Onondaga, and we went up there. First learned about reindeers and so forth, and I talked to the old man. And sure enough, there he was in the house. Pretty spry for an old man. We asked him, when did you first notice a change in the weather? Because those people live right next to the weather. They live daily, hourly even, in the weather. When did you notice? He said, 50 years ago. 50 years ago we saw the change. And we noted something is different. Something is changing. That's 50 years ago. And so now we're talking and people say, well, you know, we saw this coming 40 years ago, 50 years ago. In our prophecies, we saw it coming 200 years ago. But nevertheless, however, it's here. And that's the fact of it. And so what is here? Change is here. And that's what's here. Speaking with one of the well-known scientists, his name is Jim Hansen. He's the director of the Goddard Institute in New York. And that's his business. He said, the way he says things, he said, well, 10,000 years of good weather is over. 10,000 years of good weather is over. We've had an extraordinary run of good weather. We build our ceremonies around the weather, around the seasons. From the last ice age, we've had a good run, but it's over now. Now it's a change. And you have to prepare yourself for that change. And first of all, you got to understand, yes, it is. We've been listening to all the obfuscations, misdirections, flat-out lies, business as usual. They want to do business as usual. Well, business as usual is over. Cannot do business as usual. Just cannot. That's all there is to it. If you do, of course you can, but it's going to last a short time. So right now we're in this early, what I would call, the spring of global warming. And that's where you enjoy the warmer winter. Instead of saying, well, I hear the old folks say that. They say, snow's not sticking. Snow should be here longer. It's not sticking. We're going to lose. And then on the other hand, I hear the young people say, oh, it's nice and warm. There's no winter. It's pretty good. And people who depend on the snow or pretend on the winter say, no, that's not pretty good. That's pretty strange. It's different. Pay attention. Because the change is here. And change will get faster. It'll accelerate. It'll compound. And by the time you want to fix it, you can't catch it. Now, I'm trying to remember what year it was that Uncle first showed up at our meeting. Uncle being Inuit, or Inupiat man from Greenland, came to the elders' meeting. You remember what the year that was? Back in?
It was in
90s?
Yeah, it was up in Michigan.
Anyway, he showed up. Here he comes. He's wearing his leathers. He's wearing sealskins. And it was hot. I mean, it was hot that summer. But he didn't have a shirt on. Short, white, stocky man, beard. No doubt this is an Eskimo coming here. Here he comes, carrying his big drum. And he says, I want to talk to the elders. Yeah, I have a message. And what was his message? He said, the ice is melting. The ice is melting in the north. He's from Greenland. And he heard about our elder circle, and he came, and he gives us a message. That was years ago now. Okay, the ice is melting. And he says, it's changing our life. It's changing the way the animals behave. It's changing the way the birds fly. And he said, and we're losing the ice. He said, there's no ice on the shore now. So the seals come up in open water. You know, before they used to come up in this ice shelf, and a big bear would just sit there and patiently wait, or else the hunter would stand there and wait, and eventually he's going to come up for air, and they know that. And that's when they get their meal. Well, now there's no ice there. So the seal is coming up in open water. Ever try to catch a seal in open water? He's about what's the best swimmer out there, you know. You're not going to catch him. So the bears are hungry. And the hunters are walking on bad ice. And they go out and they don't come back anymore. That's happening more and more now. And they're really changing up north. Around the polar cap is where you see it the most and the biggest change. And we got reports. And that very same year, that very same time that Uncle came and gave us this message about the ice, we had a runner come from Alaska, Hunter. And he said his report was open water. He said, there's open water up here. We never saw that before. We never saw the ice in the Arctic melt through so it was open water. But that was his report. And when you began to see the manifestation of that, that's pretty far along already. It's like having a disease, you know, and you don't see it, and then all of a sudden you break out, or whatever, however it shows. And when that happens, almost too late then. But it's been working. It's been working underneath. And the ice has been melting all this time. Now we know. Now they're talking about it. Yes, the ice is melting. And what are you going to do about it? Well, it's not going to stop it. But we can slow it down. We can do that. By burning less carbon, putting less carbon in the air. And the scientists that we're talking now at Tilburg, they're saying, no, it can't be a carbon trading, it can't be a cap on carbon, it's zero carbon. Zero. We're already up at 389 parts per million into the atmosphere. And they say that the secure number is 350. So we got to come back and none of that. But then if you were talking to administrations and people who are in charge, say, oh, we could probably go to 450. Probably. That's our life they're talking about. And so the science is pretty much there. The ice is melting. Somebody's creeping up on me.
It's a glacier.
I'm so hard of hearing, I didn't hear a thing he said. But anyway, I think it's time.
I didn't say anything, I just blew in his ear.
Oh, yeah. Felt good, too.
No, I know it's 4:30, and I hate to interrupt him because I could listen for a lot longer, as I'm sure some others can. But we want to open it up for some Q&A for about 10 minutes, and then we can all head to our destinations that we usually head to after work. So anybody have any questions for Oren? I'll help deliver the question to him.
Yeah, or statement, or addition. You know, it doesn't have to be a question. It can be an observation or something you know that could add to this. Because we got people here from all over. What you've seen and how it works. You may not think it's important, but it might be.
I know you've mentioned this before, and just while we're on the Tilburg response to this, they had mentioned the point of no return. What part is that? How many parts is the point of no return?
Around 450, I would say. We're way past 350, so 450 would be really not a good place to be. But every year it's getting more and more. We're moving, so it's now 389. It's moving pretty fast. So, really, you should take it seriously, and you should talk to your leaders. You should talk to your leaders and say, look, I don't care what you guys are saying, but we know this is more serious than you're saying. And business is useless. It's going to count on my life, or it's going to count on my children's life. I want you to be more responsible, and I want to hear something different from you. Get on your leaders right now. Get on them. And, you know, a letter to the president saying the same thing means something. They keep track of those letters. Let me tell you, they do. They keep track of them. And they hear the people talking, and when the people start coming in, that's when they start to listen. So don't ever think that because you don't hold an important position in a government or anything that your thoughts and your ideas are not important, because they are important. And collectively, that's where we're at. This is a grassroots fight. This is coming right from who's sitting here fight. That's why I'm talking about this. Let us see you guys get into it and pay attention to it and learn about it. And I'll tell you, we got a good, University of Maine's got a really amazing grasp on this. Talking with Paul, he agreed with what we said. He said, I agree with you. He says, I see this coming. So it's here. Let's understand it better. It's up to the people here to organize this and to be able to, you know, get on to the issue. Don't ignore it. And point of no return means exactly that. Once you go past that point, and nothing you're going to do, change it. It's all downhill after that. And then the fighting will be at the end. Then people will scramble. But then, it's all for nothing. So it's not part, it's not half measure. A half measure is no measure. You got to do the whole thing. Zero carbon. Air, water, you got to find the other energy. You got to do it fast. And you got it here. You got the highest tide in the world out here. You harness that. You harness that. I mean, it's sitting there waiting. The technology is out there. All you do is organize your thoughts. It's right there. Harness it, because you're going to need it. Right now, you're getting your energy from coal fire, coal burning. That's carbon. That's carbon, big time. Okay, another question, another thought? Yes?
You said something about like racism and we don't have time for that. Can you explain a little more about that?
I really didn't hear you. Got to speak up.
You said something like, we don't have time for racism. Can you just explain a little more about that?
What did she say?
She said
we don't have time for
racism.
Yeah. Racism. You know what energy goes into racism?
Yes.
A lot of it.
Too much.
You know, I mean, okay, so maybe it's fun if you're, you know, if you're in charge. If you're the one doing the racism, but the ones receiving it. You know, it takes energy. All that kind of energy. And we just don't have time for that. And we have to be more respectful of one another. We have to work together. We have to really understand how closely we're related, and how nothing is going to change unless we do it as a unit. You know, we got to work together. No one group is going to change anything. It's going to take every one of us. And in order to do that, we have to have good relations. So start making good relations. And I think this center, this Wabanaki Center, is a good one here. That starts. You know, and branch out. I know the history. I'm a history professor. I know, but that can all change. And all I'm saying simply is, yeah, we don't have time for that. Time's a factor. Another comment? Yeah.
I think a lot of the people in the country have lost their attention when the 9/11 event took place and they grounded all the aircraft. Could not fly in the United States. What happened to the sky? It cleared right up because the jets were dumping all of that carbon in the atmosphere.
Yeah, a tremendous amount. One jet on one trip to Europe, tons go out.
Yep.
And you're crisscrossing like this. Did you ever see that thing in the morning when they say, here are the flights, and you see all the airplanes all over? And you can't even see the country. It's just nothing but airplanes, you know. That's what's going on. So all of that is part of it. So it's the other, we have to find the alternative resource for energy or else stay home. Less travel, you know. So, yeah, that's a serious part of it. And you know what it takes to run one tank in Iraq? You know how much energy goes into that? They get 4 miles a gallon for one of those. And they're all over the place. That's what's happening. It's not just a war going on. There's a pollution, huge pollution going on caused by that. So the amount of money that's going on into that fight, if there was applied here, nobody would be talking about health care. Everybody would have health care. Everybody. So it's a matter of priorities, and it's a matter of understanding. And, you know, looking out for the future. Yeah, there's a, I don't know, 1,000 ways we can cut that. I'll just say one more in that area for as far as the United States is concerned, is that the United States is accountable to 1/4. The carbon footprint of the United States is 1/4 of the carbon in the world. We have 7% of the population of the world and 1/4 of the carbon. That's something way out of balance. I remember Vice President Cheney, when he was questioned on that very remark, they said, well, look, here we are, 7% of the population, and we got 1/4 of the carbon. He said, well, we put out 1/4 of the world's energy, so that's all right. All right. Well, I guess if you own the oil company, it is, which is what he owns. So, yeah. So, if you have 1/4 of the Earth's footprint, then we can make the biggest change. We can make a big change if we decide we're going to do it. We don't have to worry about China. We don't have to worry about India, which is what they say. You know, take care of our own business. And you take, you can really make a very effective change right here at home. Okay, we take one more. Yes, sir.
I love your observation of what's going on in our continental U.S. and the polar Arctic. But I'm from Barrow, Alaska, so I think. I feel very connected to what you're saying, and because our survival and is based on necessity now, because of our villages are being washed, and not only that, our way of life is washed away with the global warming.
Yeah.
So trying to balance a way of life with a bit with a. Western science model and our way of knowing, or traditional way of knowing, is very difficult right now. But somehow we need to share this balance, which you seem to make it so easy.
Yeah.
But it's a way of life is not easy, especially with this warming trends. But we need this type of more conferences, I think.
Yeah, I mentioned my uncle from Greenland. He said, everybody's worried about the white bear. He says, everybody's got big tears and bears going away. What about us? He says, we live up there. Nobody's got any big tears for us. But that is in fact, you know, when the hunter goes out, and I've heard this from Canada, northern Canada, and up there, some of them don't come back. And because they're subsistence hunters, you've got to go. I mean, it's not as if you got a choice. You're going to go, and the dogs won't go. Dogs won't go out on the ice anymore. They know better. They're going to get out on that ice. So it means the guy's got to go on foot and find his way. And then they don't come home. Never see them again. If you've gone out on a ski-doo, you never see either one of them again. Right through the ice. That's the way life is up there. It's hard life. And they live right close to nature. I know. And I said to UNEP, the United Nations Environmental Program, I'm the liaison for indigenous people with UNEP at the UN. And I said, we have to do a film about what's going on up there. We have to show the people, because what's going on up there is not going down here yet, but it's coming. and it's coming fast. And when it comes, you're going to be in the same problem they are. You're not going to be able to keep up with it. It's real, let me tell you. It is real. And it is here. So you shouldn't let your legislatures and your representatives get away with this. You got to get on their tail and say, I want accountability here. I want to hear all these nonsense and all these lies and business issues. We got to really change our way. And you're supposed to be a leader? Well, start leading. Or we'll find somebody else who can. That's what the clan mothers say to us anyway. Pardon me? Yes, I want to comment on one more thing here. Very true. In the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which we've been fighting for at the UN since 1977, working on it, and Donna Loring, where is Donna? There she is. She was a representative here. And she got the state of Maine. This is an official document. She got the state of Maine to agree with the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. The state of Maine has taken a very strong position on our behalf. The only other state in this country that has done the same thing is Arizona. And the reason why is they had Indians down there pushing it through just the way Donna did. But it is a statement. I mean, I'm going to take this to the next UN meeting. And I'm going to say, yeah, we have friends. We have friends. And if the country and if the president is not going to sign that Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, and that's what you can do, you can send him a letter saying, Mr. President, sign that declaration, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. That'd be a good letter to send. And if you put up the network here from one university to the next right across the country, tell him so. And that's where you use your Twitter and your Tweeter and whatever. Get it out there, because that's what put him in office in the first place anyway. But here it is. So to the credit of Maine, and I'm proud of that, and I'm proud of you for doing that. And you guys can take a bow. It's good. So I guess, and we never did get to the UN, did we? Maybe next time.
So, Warren, I hope there is a next time, and I just want to say that this has been an extraordinary week for the University of Maine by having you here for this stay and for your visit. And I also want to thank you from all of us here this afternoon for this wonderful opportunity to hear your wisdom in the years of experience that you have had. And I also want to thank everyone for coming to make this crowd bigger. So thank you very much.
One more thing. When the Iroquois Nationals take the field, the Haudenosaunee team takes the field in England. We're going to be playing against the USA and against Canada and against England and Australia and the whole rest of the world as a nation with our own flag and our own anthem. And they're good boys and they're going to be up there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a great...
Good journeys for
you. Oh, yeah. Get up here.
Oh. Please, I shake your hand. I was one of the...
Thank you for accomplishing what you were going to